Hub
and Spoke Audio Collective. Before we begin, a huge thank you to all of you who support the show on Patreon. Soonish is literally a one-man podcast, and it makes a huge difference to know that so many of you believe in what I'm doing. If you're not a contributor, you can sign up at patreon.com/soonish. And listen up, this June and July only, if you sign up as a new supporter on Patreon at the $5 per episode level or above, I'll send you a free autographed copy of 12 Tomorrows, the new science fiction collection that I edited. I'm about to tell you all about the book in this episode, so go now to patreon.com/soonish, and thanks. I'm Wade Rausch, and this is Soonish. It's a podcast from the high-tech hub of Boston, where we ask what the world of tomorrow will look like, and how each of us can make it our own. Because the future is shaped by technology, but technology is shaped by us. There's a really popular website for video gamers called Polygon. And this summer, the site published an article that went super viral. It was about the original Star Wars movie from 1977, and it asked what the world might have looked like if George Lucas had never made the film. The writer, Kevin Lincoln, really knows his Hollywood history, and he makes a pretty good case that Star Wars basically created the market for summer blockbuster movies. So without Star Wars, we wouldn't have had Raiders of the Lost Ark, or Star Trek the Motion Picture, or a bunch of other big-budget special effects movies. 20th Century Fox was in poor financial health in the late 1970s, and without Star Wars, it might have gone out of business, which means we never would have had Fox News. And that makes it easier to imagine an alternate timeline where Al Gore beats George W. Bush in the 2000 presidential election, and so on. Now, this piece in Polygon was a little bit far-fetched in places, but for me, it reinforced an idea that I already believed in, which is that Star Wars is probably the most important movie ever made. Not important in an artistic sense, necessarily, but important in the sense that it changed everything that came after it. I have a pair of friends named Jason Ponton and Mark Ponton. They're brothers, and recently they co-wrote a piece that blames Star Wars for one change in particular, namely, the death of serious science fiction. Not just on the big screen, but in books, too. They wrote that Star Wars showed publishers that there's a huge potential readership for stories that, quote, tap the collective unconscious without engaging the higher brain functions, unquote. They said that Star Wars did to grown-up science fiction what the Death Star did to Alderaan. The bigger argument Mark and Jason were making was that in classic science fiction, there was some actual science. It was there to bring some realism and get readers to think about how their own world might change in the future. The golden age for this kind of sci-fi lasted from the 1940s to the 1960s, and it was led by famous authors like Arthur C. Clarke and Robert Heinlein and Ray Bradbury and Isaac Asimov. But after Star Wars, sci-fi writers learned that the way to make a profit was to tell stories on a grand mythological scale. You only had to have enough science and technology to make your setting seem futuristic. It was okay to throw the rest of physics out the window. It was even okay to bring in purely magical elements like the Force. Now, you could try to dismiss Mark and Jason's argument by saying that Star Wars isn't science fiction at all, that it's more like a space opera. But if you look at the business of science fiction after Star Wars, it really did turn into this giant money amoeba, and it stuck out its gooey protoplasm arms in three main directions, namely fantasy, dystopian cyberpunk, and superhero adventures. That's how we ended up with giant franchises like The Matrix, and The Lord of the Rings, and Game of Thrones, and the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe, and all the related comics and novelizations and merchandise. But ever since the 1970s, there's been a ragtag band of science fiction writers and readers who want to reach back to the golden age before Star Wars and resurrect a literary form known as hard science fiction. You might have noticed that Soonish has been on a bit of a break the last few months, and that's partly because I've been off working on a project to do exactly that. Specifically, I've been editing a new collection of hard science fiction stories published by MIT Technology Review magazine and the MIT Press. The book finally came out this May, and it's called 12 Tomorrows. So I want to explain how I ended up editing the book, and then introduce you to four of the authors who wrote stories for it. If I'm lucky, I'll end up convincing you to go out and buy a copy. And if you listen all the way to the end of the show, I'll give you a code that you can use to get a discount. But I also want to take a deep look at this phenomenon of hard science fiction and explore why it's a worthwhile thing for writers to write and for readers to read. One thing I've learned from this project is that writing hard science fiction is a little bit like doing actual science. In the laboratory, researchers design experiments so that they can change one variable at a time. If they let all the variables swing all over the place, they'd have such a mess that they'd never be able to isolate cause and effect. In hard science fiction, writers decide up front that they're going to work within the rules of real physics and real biology. That lets them depict alternate worlds that feel like our actual world, except that technology has advanced in some specific way. And then they can explore the effects of those changes in ways that feel relevant to us here today. And that's not so different from what I do here on the podcast. Just to head off one possible misunderstanding right from the beginning, I am not a Star Wars hater. The original movies made a deep impression on me as a kid. I love space operas, and fantasy, and cyberpunk, and superheroes. I also like Frosted Flakes and Captain Crunch. But that doesn't mean I eat them for breakfast every morning. So, if you take Star Wars out of the equation, like Polygon did, and you ask what's the most important science fiction movie ever made, I think your answer would have to be Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey. The very first episode of Soonish was all about that movie. And when I was doing the interviews for that episode, I wanted to go and talk to one of the biggest science fiction fans I know. That was my friend Jason Ponton. And it was Jason who later got me involved in the 12 Tomorrows project. So I'm going to revisit a bit of that conversation here. This was December of 2016, and at the time, Jason was the editor-in-chief and publisher of MIT Technology Review magazine. And I asked him to tell me about the first time he saw 2001.
I can kind of recapture, Wade, my emotional feeling about it. I remember being fairly unimpressed by the prehistoric scenes, but I remember being powerfully impacted by Dave up in space alone with his only companion as Hal, mm-hmm. and their conversation and their relationship. It's a very creepy and surreal thing, the way they talk to each other.
Good evening, Dave.
How you doing, Hal?
Everything's running smoothly, and you?
Oh, not too bad.
Have you been doing some more work?
A few sketches.
May I see them?
Sure.
That's a very nice rendering, Dave. I think you've improved a great deal.
And what's very original about the movie is that they really do treat each other on terms of absolute equality. So that's never questioned. Dave absolutely knows that Hal is a fully thinking, conscious, reasoning being like himself, but made of different matter.
You're working up your crew psychology report.
Of course I am. Sorry about this. I know it's a bit silly.
And they both have a morality, and the morality is very different. And I that made a big impression. I mean, I still remember that.
Right. And then it becomes his unfortunate job to kill Hal in order to save his own life.
Yeah. And he does it efficiently and effectively because Kubrick's vision of an astronaut still then is of the Neil Armstrong era. He has the right stuff. He gets on with the job. He's an engineer. He knows how to take Hal apart. But he does it with no pleasure or vindictiveness at all. Mm-hmm.
It was both brilliant marketing and a little bit dangerous to give an actual date, right? To attach a date to this movie, because that's putting a marker in down and saying, we think the world is going to look like this in 33 years. And
I love it that it has a date, though. Science fiction is seldom really been about its predictive power. It's a commentary on on the present and present expectations on the future. Stuart Brand, the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, once said that we know the past, but we cannot influence it. And we do not know the future, but we can influence that. And I always think about these predictions as ways of managing our anxiety and our expectations about the present, and an appeal to the present to drive towards the future in a way that the author finds more pleasing or palatable or less fearful. So I love it that these 1984 and 2001 have dates attached to them, because it makes explicit what these movies are really about, which is they're really about 1968 and 1948. And I find that pleasing.
Right.
My last question is about the annual Technology Review science fiction issue, which has become a little bit of a tradition, right? You've done it three or four times now?
Yeah, I think the next one will be number five. It is called 12 Tomorrows, because there are 12 bits inside it, one of which is a long interview by me with a science fiction writer who I love. I usually find some old geezer like Gene Wolfe, who I want to talk to while he's still alive. There's a photo gallery that recovers the great art of the golden age of science fiction. But the rest of it, the other 10 parts, are good old-fashioned clanking hard science fiction. And those science fiction stories are deliberately inspired, like science fiction was during its great day, by an editor, me, taking something that appeared in our case in Technology Review and saying, imagine a world where gene editing is common. Imagine a world where AIs are as common as television sets. And then we find a writer who would be good at that. So we don't allow any fantasy, no unicorns or swords. It has to be relatively near term. It has to be scientifically literate, and it has to be inspired by something we've actually written about in the last 12 to 18 months. And I do it because I believe the secret religion of everyone who got into technology, including you and me, is science fiction. That's why we did it, because we read stuff like 2001 and we were inspired by it. They were thought experiments, a different way, as I say, to think about the present and extrapolate what might happen. And I'm the biggest science fiction nerd on the planet, and I just think science fiction has been going in a terrible direction really since the cyberpunks. I mean, that's the last period when I really enjoyed reading science fiction. And there are a few authors who I look forward to reading, but by and large, the science fiction which I grew up loving, both at a literary level and at just in terms of how it was a bomb going off on my mind, that wasn't being written about anymore.
Now, that conversation must have gotten Jason thinking, because a month later, he called me and asked if I wanted to edit the fifth edition of 12 Tomorrows, to which I said yes, absolutely. That meant I had to go out and find a group of writers who'd be willing to take on this assignment to write some good old-fashioned clanking hard science fiction. Jason's brother, Mark Ponton, is an even bigger science fiction fan. You could say they've got a bit of a Sherlock and Mycroft thing going. Mark helped me connect with several authors and advised me on how to edit fiction, which I'd never done before. And Mark and Jason co-wrote a profile of the legendary science fiction author Samuel R. Delaney. That's the piece where they called Star Wars an extinction-level event for hard science fiction. In the end, we found 11 amazing authors to help us bring hard science fiction back from extinction. And after a lot of work by a lot of people, we all gathered this June to launch the book at an event hosted by the MIT Press Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Thanks, John. Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for coming tonight to be part of this conversation. So we're going to be talking about the subgenre of science fiction called hard science fiction. And that means peering into the near future through fiction, which we think can help us understand technology and its impact now in the present. Obviously, we're also celebrating the release of the 2018 edition of 12 Tomorrows. And I'm so honored that these three writers could contribute to the book and that they could join us tonight. If the other eight authors were here, I would say the same thing about them, because they all rose to the challenge we set out, which was to send us stories that would be dramatic and human and funny and tragic, but that would also explore the impacts of hypothetical technology advances in ways that journalists just can't, because they haven't happened yet. The catch was that the stories should be realistic and should hinge on technologies that might plausibly exist in the future based on the trends that we could see now. So, no warp drives, no flux capacitors, and definitely no midichlorians. So that said, I want to introduce you to our amazing guests. Elizabeth Baer on the horn. Ken Liu. And Lisa Wong. So their bios are in the book, but I can't help saying a little bit myself about them. So Baer has written nearly 30 novels, including Karen Memory, The Stone in the Skull, and Stone Mad, and I think at least two of them are on the table over here. Her 12 Tomorrows story is a really delightful one about a reclusive billionaire programmer who winds up in a very conflicted relationship with his house. More specifically, with a program named Glory that he wrote to manage his house. Glory is sort of what Alexa might become if she watched too many episodes of Doomsday Preppers. Ken is the author of an epic fantasy series called The Dandelion Dynasty that began with The Grace of Kings and continued with The Wall of Storms. He's a lawyer and a programmer who lives outside Boston. His story for 12 Tomorrows is a complex dual narrative about two women who have conflicting philosophies about how we should do humanitarian work and how new technologies like virtual reality and blockchain could help bring that kind of conflict to a head. Okay. Finally, Lisa, who writes as S.L. Huang, is an MIT graduate, a firearms expert, and a Hollywood stuntwoman, in addition to being an Amazon best-selling author. Her debut novel, Zero Sum Game, is coming up from Tor Books in September. Her 12 Tomorrow Stories looks at the possibility that we'll be able to reprogram our own thinking using deep brain implants and the kind of emotional Pandora's box that that might open up. I'm gonna leave time for Q&A, but I wanna pose a question to the three of you. Now, I'm not sure, Lisa, whether you've ever written fantasy-inflected science fiction. Okay, so I think all three of you have. This is not that. This is hard science fiction. And I just wanted to ask you to say a little bit about the differences. Like, how does your thinking, your writing process, your inventive process differ if you're trying to hew to known facts and plausible science? Is it harder? Is it easier?
Hard science fiction it's more meticulous. In fantasy, at least for me, you start with the thing you want to write about, whatever argument it is that you want to have on the page, and you set up the rules of the world so that you can have that argument. And the world will sort of have that argument for you, if that makes any sense. And in hard science fiction, I mean, you have rules. You have the rules of the real world. Somebody else has already set that stuff up for you. I think it was Charlie Strauss who made the statement that you get to break one law of physics per work of hard science fiction. but if you can get away without breaking any, that's even more fun. So it's formal. Hard science fiction is formal, like a sonnet.
I was also going to say something about setting up the rules of the world. Yeah. I think about it very similarly because pretty much everything I write is very similar in the sense that I don't break my own rules, and I'm very meticulous about that as a writer. Now, don't get me wrong, I love fiction that does break rules. Hitchhiker's Guide, Harry Potter, you know, like these worlds break their own rules in ways that really work. So maybe they aren't breaking their own rules, I don't know. But I tend to very carefully set up my worlds, whether they're hard science fiction or whether they're fantasy or magical realism, and stay within that framework. I feel like my process is similar with pretty much all types of fiction. I mean, I feel like they can be equally creative and equally like commenting on the world.
How about you, Ken?
So I guess for me, the difference really is where the metaphors come from. So the way I think about fantasy and science fiction is actually very similar. I think they're both literature of the fantastic in which metaphors are made literally true. The difference is that when I'm doing something that's not hard sci-fi, I tend to come up with the metaphors, then I just make the world fit. I just make a fantastical leap. With hard sci-fi, what I tend to do is to be inspired by the metaphors that are there in the science, because one of the things that people don't necessarily, I mean, people here appreciate, but the larger society sometimes don't quite appreciate is how poetic science actually is. The language of science is full of poetry and metaphors, you know, charm and strange, and the idea of Byzantine generals as a metaphor for how you think about distributed trust. And I just love that. And so when I do hard sci-fi, what I tend to do is to read science papers and then be inspired by the metaphors that are in the science and then try to create a story around that.
So Q&A, I'm gonna play Phil Donahue and take the mic around to folks. Who wants to ask a question of our marvelous panel?
Why do you think so much science fiction is dystopian?
Because it's much easier to write conflict into dystopian
universes. That is so true.
Because we're lazy. Because writers are lazy and utopias are hard. I actually, the book I have coming out next March, Ancestral Night, is a far future science fiction novel in the mold of Ian Banks or C.J. Cherry. And it's not utopian, but it does posit a better form of government and a generally better society. I mean, they still have problems. They have a lot of problems. The premise of this is that, of course, we will have to intentionally hack human brains to make them less toxic before this is possible, which isn't problematic at all and isn't a technology that anyone would ever abuse.
You know, this is something that I struggle with as a reader and science fiction fan, and something I that finds itself into my writing, because as somebody who loves science, and as somebody who's like really a fan of science and modernism and futurism, I love my science fiction. I love reading dystopias, but I don't like to see science demonized. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is a real conflict for me when I'm reading a work that explicitly does that. And it makes its way into my own work, of course, because I try very hard not to do that. You know, even if I'm writing something more dystopian, it's usually not the technology that's like the demonizing factor. And your question earlier, Wade, about like what drew me to this, one of the other things was that the initial pitch was that this was going to be optimistic science fiction that was going to be talking about the possibilities in technology, which is something that I immediately was in love with as a concept.
So you mentioned you're a programmer by profession earlier, right? So, I'm in computer science myself, and I happen to write as a hobbyist, but how do you get over this, this dilemma of whether to, write about stuff that you'd like to see or actually, working towards it? So how do you balance that? I mean, since you're into both fields?
My answer is I've had a lot of weird careers, but it doesn't, they're all sort of unified, because ultimately in this economy, in this late capitalism age, what we all do is just manipulating symbols, right? None of us actually make anything and do anything real. All we do is manipulating symbols. We put them from one spreadsheet to another and arrange symbols on the screen, and we make money from that. So as far as fiction writing and being a lawyer and being a programmer is concerned, I'm doing the same thing. I'm building symbolic structures that follow certain rules to achieve certain results. And so that was how I balanced everything. To me, I was just doing the same thing. I'm either building a machine, a legal machine, to allow my client to not pay taxes, or I'm building an actual, you know, a Turing machine, a tape for a Turing machine that will achieve a particular result, or I'm simply writing a emotional empathy machine to allow the reader to feel something. That's really always the same.
So that's a taste of our 12 Tomorrows launch event. We'll post the full video of the event, including readings from the three authors' stories, at soonishpodcast.org. I really love what Ken Liu was saying about how one difference between fantasy and science fiction is where the metaphors come from. In the case of fantasy, the metaphors often come from mythology or straight from the author's imagination. In hard science fiction, they're often coming from science itself. But metaphors also come from the lives writers live and the cultures they're part of. And that's part of the reason I was so thrilled to get a story from Nnedi Okorafor. Nnedi is a professor of creative writing and literature at the University of Buffalo. She writes science fiction and fantasy stories that evoke the cultures of Africa, including her parents' home country of Nigeria. She wrote a novel set in post-apocalyptic Africa called Who Fears Death that's now being developed as a drama series for HBO. And for 12 Tomorrows, Okorafor wrote a story set in a near-future version of Nigeria where a political reformer who's been elected president needs a heart transplant. He winds up getting what's called a Zyborg heart, grown from plant cells, and while he's in surgery, his political rivals use the public's reaction to this Zyborg heart story to stir up some serious mischief. Okorafor visited the MIT Media Lab back in March, and she was part of a panel discussion led by Media Lab professor Joseph Paradiso, where she talked about the origins of her fiction and how writing hard sci-fi has started to change her as a writer.
My point of view is a little different here, and it's interesting being here because I first really started off writing kind of fantasy, magical realism kind of stuff, African-rooted. And there's a reason for that, but I'm not going to go too deeply into it. A lot of it has to do with just my magical worldview. I see the world as a magical place. So that's how I started off writing. And then somewhere along the line, both of my parents, they're Nigerian, I'm Nigerian-American, and my parents have been taking my siblings and I back to Nigeria since I was very young. And as I grew older, like, these trips used to be, they were paradise, you know. Those trips really painted my world, because growing up in the United States versus with going to Nigeria, like, my world was always bigger. So that was already there. So as I grew older, It became more than just this beautiful place where all of my relatives were and we just had so much fun. I started noticing the political situations, but in particular, I started noticing the difference in the use of technology in Nigeria versus in the United States. For example, portable devices became very important over there before they were here. Think of laptops versus desktop computers. Desktop computers were really important here for a long time. Over there, not so much because of the infrastructure. The power was going on and off, and if you have a desktop computer, that becomes a problem. So laptops became popular there. Cell phones became popular there very early on. So I started noticing these things, and then I started thinking about the science fiction that I was seeing, and I felt like it was not portraying that part of the world, the continent of Africa, the cultures of Africa, with that in mind. I was seeing Africa portrayed as a place of the past. I was seeing Africa portrayed as a country as opposed to a continent, etc. And so that kind of led me to start thinking about science fiction and looking into the future and seeing Africa in the future. So that was really where it began, and that was really where the change kind of started with my with the stories that I was telling. I've always been interested, this is another thing, I've always been interested in the narrative very much so, not just the science of it, but the where the narrative lies within the scientific. So my first novel, Zara the Windseeker, featured a place like Nigeria, but it was technologically advanced. And that technology was blended with biotechnology. So you had plant towers, you had CPU seeds that grew into computers, you had cars that were run on electricity producing roots, et cetera.
So the first thing I'll ask, you know, I like the science to be right, although it doesn't have to be, but this is an interesting tension that science fiction explores. So how important is it really to get the science right? So Ned, you tell some of the best stories in the business. So what's your take on this?
Oh, I thank you. I think that, well, first and foremost, I'm a storyteller. That's always the place that I'm coming from. I think that I'm interested in the how of it, but I'm more interested in how or what we do when we know how. I feel like the scientists have the how covered. I get a lot of my material from what they're doing and what their research tells me. So in that way, the getting things scientifically correct is important, but it's from that standpoint, from my obsession, not that I feel some kind of pressure of, oh, I can't write about this because it's not realistic or it's impossible. As a science fiction writer, I feel like those are not things that should ever stop me from writing what I'm writing. I think that one of the important things about science fiction is that it can go beyond the possible and the proven and kind of play around. That's the agency that we have as science fiction writers. So there's that. But I do think that for a story to be realistic, it needs to be as close to scientifically correct as possible. It needs to follow that line of logic. And then at some point you jump the rails and that's where the science fiction begins. But you still need to follow that logic. And I think that the reason why something being realistic is important is because for the sake of the story to work, for the sake of the reader to believe what you're writing, and the believing is what pulls the reader in. What pulls the reader in gives that feeling of actually being there. If it's not realistic, the reader falls out of the story and doesn't experience the narrative as it should be experienced. So that's why that's important. But for me as the writer, a lot of those things that I'm obsessed with are where the realism comes from. I'm slowly changing as a writer right now because I'm getting more and more obsessed with things being scientifically correct. I haven't written that many hard science fiction stories, but I've written two, and there's one that's going to be in the MIT anthology 12 Tomorrows. And for that story, I had to do so much research on heart transplants, 3D printed hearts. It's about a president who has a heart transplant, so obviously. But like also vegetable hearts, like hearts that are made from vegetable leaves. And I had to do so much research. And in doing that research, you know, there was a joy in it. The story was really in the facts and in kind of pushing beyond those facts. And I really enjoyed that. So I think that I can see myself writing more of that. I think that there's something very fertile in that.
After the panel ended, I went and found Nettie backstage, and we had a brief chat.
What was it like to write hard science fiction? The story that I wrote for 12 Tomorrows was basically the first complete hard science fiction story that I've written, and I loved it, and I will do more because, one, you know, I was asked to look at research of what MIT is doing, various things that MIT is doing, and that led me down this rabbit hole of just looking at all of this stuff, this amazing research that is being done right now, and I couldn't believe a lot of what I was seeing. And so weaving that into a narrative was it was a brand new experience for me, but it also, I think, it changed me as a writer. You know, I think that I finally kind of got it, like, you know, this whole thing with hard science fiction and what's so important about it and what's so intoxicating about it, I finally got it. So yeah, it was a really great experience.
And you think you might do more?
I definitely will do more, yes.
Fantastic. It was great working with you, Nettie, and I was so lucky that you said yes to the whole project, so thank you.
My pleasure.
So in the end, if you ask me what's the big difference between hard science fiction and the rest of science fiction, I go back to the ideas you heard from Elizabeth Baer and Lisa Huang and Ken Liu and Nettie Okorafor. It's about which rules the author decides to follow and which metaphors they decide to use. Even fantasy stories have their own rules and logic. If you're writing a story set in the universe of Star Wars, or Star Trek, or Marvel, or Harry Potter, you've got to observe those rules, or the fans are going to be pretty upset. And in hard science fiction, you also have to follow the rules. But they're the rules of actual science. It can be a challenge to write within those rules, but what you get in return is an extra level of realism. As Nnedi Okorafor said, that helps to keep the reader inside your story, and it can also help your story function as social commentary. There's still plenty of room for stories about people who fly dragons, or cast spells, or use force powers. It's just that those stories don't usually have a lot to say about the real world and how we can change it. If you're searching for stories that hit you like a bomb going off in your mind, they are out there. You just have to look a little harder. Soonish is written and produced by me, Wade Rausch. The show's theme is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. All of our other music this week is by Joel Roston and Andrew Willis of Title Card Music in Boston. In today's show, you met Elizabeth Baer, Lisa Huang, Ken Liu, and Nnedi Okorafor. 12 Tomorrows also has amazing stories from 7 other writers, including Clifford Johnson, J.M. Ledgard, Liu Cixin, Paul McCauley, Malka Older, Sarah Pinsker, and Alistair Reynolds. There are a bunch of ways to get hold of the book. As I said at the top of the show, I'll send a free autographed copy to everyone who signs up as a new Soonish patron on Patreon at the $5 level or above before July 31st. To sign up and claim your bonus book, go to patreon.com/soonish. You can also get 30% off the book's list price when you order directly from the MIT Press's distributor, Triliteral. All you have to do is call Triliteral at 1-800-405-1619 and mention the code SOONISH30. You can order by email using the same code at orders@triliteral.org. That's 1-800-405-1619 or orders@triliteral.org. Discount code SOONISH30. The discount expires July 31st, so order now. Of course, you can also ask for the book at your local bookstore or get it online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, Indigo, or Powell's. Special thanks this week to Jason Ponton, Mark Ponton, the folks at MIT Technology Review, and everybody at the MIT Press, including Amy Brand, Susan Buckley, Kathleen Caruso, Marge Encomienda, Colleen Lanick, Jeremy Matthews, Elizabeth Moore, and Noah Springer. Thanks also to Kip Clark and Mark Polovsky. Joseph Friedman recorded our MIT Press Bookstore event on audio and video, and we plan to post the video from the event on our website, soonishpodcast.org. Soonish is available wherever you get your podcasts, including the NPR One app. And another great place to hear the show is on Radio Public. The app is free and easy to use. And get this, Radio Public pays podcasters every time their show gets played in the app. So when you listen to Soonish on Radio Public, everyone benefits. Soonish is a proud founding member of Hub and Spoke, a Boston-centric collective of idea-driven podcasts. Ministry of Ideas is one of the shows in Hub and Spoke, and I want to recommend their recent episode, Apocalyptic Politics. You've probably seen plenty of stories trying to explain how a man as irreligious as Donald Trump has such strong support from the religious right in America. Well, this episode finally connected all the dots for me. Spoiler alert, it's about Trump's support for Israel and Israel's role in Scripture as the place where the end times will supposedly begin. Apocalyptic Politics is a gripping episode, and you can find it at ministryofideas.org. And you can check out the whole collection of Hub and Spoke shows at hubspokeaudio.org. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with a new episode soonish.